Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
There's a cat over here. There's a cat over there. And the wrong one died. And the wrong one died.
Welcome to The Wrong Cat Died, the podcast breakdown of Catastrophe. I'm your host, Mike Abrams, and today we have a little bit of a different guest. She's a political cartoonist and satirist from Washington, D.C. She has written many Cats parodies and probably is the only person that I've seen write a positive review on the 2019 movie. So, welcome, Alexandra Bauman. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Mike. This is a massive honor. Like you said, like I am not a cast member. I am a 22-year-old punk who has written some articles that I find entertaining. I hope others do as well. And I'm eager just to talk about, I guess, what the experience of writing those is like and being like a Cats evangelist in my friend circles. And frankly,
it's really
it's relieving to speak with you because I fall into like a just hideous a variant on the main character syndrome where I feel like I am the only Cats fan in the world. So it's good to know there are other people.
There are. So it's interesting to say because there are a lot of Cats super fans, like extreme fans.
Yeah.
And then there's like a group that enjoys the show. And then there's a bunch of people that hate it. But everyone that hates it has never, I've never met anybody that's given me a real reason. It's just like, it's not their thing.
Yeah. Yeah. From what I can tell, just from an unfortunate quantity of conversations I've had with friends is they hate this idea that it was so financially successful and so widely viewed, despite having what they would call heavy air quotes, no plot. Like they're angry at the success. And I think a hatred or dislike for something often comes from like some kind of envy or it's like, you're not even a playwright. Oh, like you don't even write musicals. What are you envious about? But it's this like hatred at this group of masses that they can't even name. It's something like that.
I think that's an interesting piece because it's like I've never I don't even know how to describe myself. I don't know if I call myself a fan. I don't hate it.
You run a podcast, Nick.
I feel like I know a lot about it.
Sure.
I've learned a lot about it.
Yeah.
But I'm in the boat of where I think it was written wrong. I didn't like the fact that there was no plot, but I never really thought that that's a reason to hate it. Like it's successful. Like kudos, make that money. Like Andrew, keep cashing those checks.
Correct.
But it is interesting because it's just like, it is not everyone's cup of tea because it isn't a neat, tidy plot. And it's kind of strange. And that part is where I get like, it's an easy punchline, hence a show like this. But let's start at the beginning. When did you first see it? Did you see it as a kid? Did you see it as an adult?
Yeah, actually, I was interning at the Library of Congress in 2019 in the summer. And I was one day just sent to do work in like the main atrium room. So I had time to like be free on Twitter and kind of go off task. And the trailer came out that day. And it was the day that the trailer came out that sucked me in. I had realized a couple months later that my grandpa had given me Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats years ago. And he had mentioned there was some larger pop culture attachment to it, but I didn't really know what he meant. And I've been taking piano lessons since like age 5. And my teacher once mentioned there was a musical about cats. So I was aware of it. But the trailer was just so captivating. And I mean that as a joke, obviously. But I also was like, I can't believe there's a musical about fluffy animals. That's so cool.
And you never saw a stage production. You didn't even know really, you like had a loose idea that existed. And the 2019 trailer, the movie trailer is what, that is probably the only good news I've heard come from the movie. Is that it created a fan. It created a fan now.
Oh, very much. Yeah. I just, I learned very quickly what it was. I watched the trailer a couple times and did some research, kind of a rabbit hole that day. And then I realized very quickly that it was based on a book of whimsical, like British American, but we'll just say British, you know, British children's poetry about cats. And I have loved Beatrix Potter since age 5. You know, I guess my first crush was Geronimo Stilton. You know, I love the idea that anthropomorphic animals can be used to make like morality tales more accessible for a wide audience. sense. And so the idea that there was this like juxtaposition of, this was something I wrote in one of the articles I did for the Broadway Beat, like this glorious juxtaposition of the formal and the stupid. And it was also wildly successful. And it was also something that I could use as a personality trait for years to come. So it was that a conglomeration of things that kind of drew me in.
Did you see the 2019 movie before you've ever seen, have you seen a stage production of it yet?
A production, actually, I have a bulletin board behind my laptop and I have my ticket from the Kennedy Center. I saw it in October 2019 at the Kennedy Center. So I saw the
right
stage
before
production
the movie.
A month before. I think I had I went on a trip to Germany with my family. My dad was on a business trip, and like throughout that trip, I listened to Beautiful Ghosts like over and over and over again. And that was, I think, early November. So yeah, I'm grateful that like God at least gave me the stage production, so I had something to go off of and wasn't completely turned off by the movie.
Yeah. So you would have saw the touring cast. Mm-hmm. From the touring cast six before, because that was a group that went, that got like abruptly ended by COVID, and you saw it in DC. Okay, so you got to like, you basically went all in 2019. It's like stage production, trailer to the movie.
Correct.
And it became your personality.
I'm allowed to make that joke. Yes,
okay,
it
I'm
did.
Not allowed to
but that's fine. No, it became as I kind of wrote in one of those articles that I wrote. It's just shocking how so much of the show's ethos matches up with my pre-existing personality. And I know that's that's something that really centers me. But I just love anthropomorphic animal stories. I love music that is like bombastic and expressive. A variety of styles, like it I love. Let me pull up the article. Let's see if this doesn't take too long.
So this is for everyone that's listening. This is the Broadway Beat article, right? This is the
correct,
which is a parody Broadway. Like, is it a website? I mean, I've always seen it on social media.
Yeah, it's a like satire publication.
It kind of reminds me of The Onion. It's the Onion, but for theater.
Correct. It's The Onion, but for theater, and they. Yeah, we have a Slack. We pitch headlines in the Slack. They tell us at the end of the week which ones get selected. And I wrote a headline. Basically, we pitch headlines, and then if the headlines are accepted, they tell us to go write the articles. And so
do
I
they pay you for this?
They pay me. I want to not shame my boss. I won't tell you how much or they pay me. But I mean, I say that because they barely pay us, but we do technically get paid.
Okay. I feel like this is my wheelhouse. I feel like I should be writing for them.
Oh gosh, yes, you should. You absolutely should. Please. And I know they've changed their system, but I know that originally, I need to check what it is now. You had to send in 5 pitches. Again, I don't know what it is now, so I don't even know if this is helpful, practical information. But you had to send in 5 pitches. If they accepted one, then you became a contributing writer and didn't have to send in 5 at a time anymore. And you could just send in one. But to not drive my editor nuts, I just always sent them in groups of 10. And then like a month ago, we moved to Slack. And so now we just send them all in Slack. And then at the end of the week, our editor will put up a doc based on like a editor leadership meeting and tell us which ones they want articles for. But I was in the old guard. As of like 6 months ago, when
I'll just write cats headlines all day.
Please. I mean, they have a timely headline pitch section and then like a normal one, these will eternally be relevant. So there's demand for all kinds of content. And I'm sure the cast content is, there's just so much. It's I've been able to write so much because there's just unlimited fodder. It's a tragic amount of fodder for punching down. But if you're punching down at yourself, it's fine. So the headline I wrote was local woman's personality just dripping with quote, allowed to see cats too young. So I'll just preface this by saying like I mentioned that I found out about it personally in November or summer 2019 when the trailer came out, but I was just astounded as I was writing this, just again, how much of my preset personality matched with that of the ethos of the show, if you will. Totally. I can read a little bit. Do you want me to, is that okay?
Yeah.
Just to give people
just
any
to give
kind
some,
of idea of
give some preface
about.
Too, is this, I got sent this by multiple different people.
And did you?
Yes. Cause I'm in the small little circle that I live in where I'm the main character. I'm the cats person. And so I got sent it and it was hilarious and I want you to read a little bit of it. And then I realized, which is why we're talking today, is that when I got to your website and some of the other stuff you've done is I read some of your other things that also got sent to me a while before that one pieced together. Like even you have a cartoon with Buster for Jones and James Corden. And even like that, I was like, I remember seeing this. Someone sent this to me like when the movie came out. And so a lot of this stuff has come together to where it's like very clear that your satire is right in the same wheelhouse that I like to live. So it's perfect. So,
thank
so share
you.
A little bit, because everyone that is listening to this is likely a Cats fan that will also hopefully find a lot of this very humorous.
Thank you. And also just very briefly, like it is so wonderful to hear that because I post a lot on social media and many or most, if not all of my biggest resume bullets that I'm most proud of. And I'm a 22-year-old. I'm a Georgetown senior. I'm graduating in a week, like literally a week to the day. And I spend a lot of time on social media and my biggest jobs have come as a result of Twitter. So I've been able to justify my continued overusage of social media. But it means a lot to hear that I'm not just posting into the void and to be reassured that it's actually brightening people's lives. Yeah. Oh, Lord, what a relief. But yeah.
So like and subscribe.
Yeah, exactly. So, there's so much good stuff here. I'm trying to figure out what to say. It's not that long. You just stop me when you want me to stop. Is that okay? Just
read the whole thing. Read the whole thing. Thank you. We got time.
Fantastic. All right, I'll try to do this without snick laughing at my own jokes. Yeah. Local woman Alice Browman, wink wink, has recently drawn attention for, in a way that is more simultaneously implicit and explicit than anything else in history, having a personality just gushing with the glaring fact that she was allowed to ingest Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical Cats far too young. Quote, I'm not a furry or anything, said Browman to our reporter, wearing an Animaniacs t-shirt and holding a laptop adorned with stickers featuring Garfield, Tom and Jerry, Puss in Boots, and the Cheshire Cat. I'm a furry in the way Beatrix Potter was a furry. See, that's what I said. I think anthropomorphic animals are an ideal way for artists and writers to convey meaning through metaphors that are easy to comprehend, in line with literary tradition, and utterly charming to children and adults alike. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to finish my paper on T.S. Eliot for my Georgetown Master's in English. No, of course I didn't understand a word of The Wasteland. This paper is on, paragraph break. According to local friend of Browman, Betty Carlton's is a friend on one of my friend's names who's a hater, all of Browman's deepest interests juxtapose the formal and the stupid. Quote, she's simultaneously as interested in methods of literary critical theory as she is in videos of cute furry animals slamming into glass doors thinking they were windows, said Carlton, holding her head in her hands and staring at a chessboard to communicate the image of a smart person engaging with perplexity. And also, I don't know why she feels the need to explain all the time she's not crazy and that Cats is really mainstream. No one's critiquing it. Oh, and every time she texts me about Cats, I tell her she's insane and needs to stop before I block her. Browman's piano teacher, John Ferguson, Joan Ferguson, who was my teacher, noted that much of I made a typo, I wrote Bowman and then my editor didn't catch it. So it says Bowman on the site. that much of Browman's artistic taste also seems to juxtapose the tastes of the masses, as well as those with an eye for the classic and complex. She values boldness and spectacle with a healthy sense of tradition and technical intricacy. She's fascinated by a vast eclectic variety of artistic styles, all with this definitive sense of flashy spectacle and desire to shock through vivid characterization. It's exhausting. Quote, she seems to be drawn towards media that are an acquired taste but simultaneously benefit from mainstream appeal, said Ferguson, making us think of Matcha Tea, I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson and Antifa. Quote, let's hope that when she finally grows up, she leans more into the Andrew Lloyd Webber side of that spectrum and not the Tim Burton side, end quote. At press time, we received word from a local lab that Browman is not like this because of early exposure to Cats, but instead a dysfunctional nuclear power plant. That's it.
Love it. Absolutely love it. There's so much in there. I like immediately think of the hot dog meme just because you like threw that reference in there.
We're all trying to find the guy who did that.
Yeah, exactly.
Andrew Lloyd Webber hides in a basement.
I didn't post it. There's so many things that I start like memeing and then I'm like, no one's gonna get this, and then I end up deleting it. And I was gonna do that for when the movie came out. Like Andrew Lloyd Webber of the like who found the guy who did this, like, yeah, you greenlight this movie even though you stepped away from it. It's a full article. I want you to, when this episode comes out, send this the episode to your hater friend and say, hey, look, this is real. I've made it.
Yeah. look, there's a podcast where they invite cast members and they asked me.
Exactly.
It's crazy. I don't know why I'm here. I'm frankly offended on their behalf that I, on your behalf, that you invited me.
But no, anyway. No, this is great. I think, to me, the mix of this podcast is, yes, it's mostly cast members because they're the ones that have the most knowledge to speak about it. But I think the fan in, I really still want to find a hater, but like the people that have some like experiences tied to the show, is fun because it's what makes it so unique. And as long as, I mean, we'll get to the $1 million question at the end, but like my critique of the show has nothing to do with, I couldn't tell you the first thing about the musical numbers or dancing or any of that stuff. I can tell you about the plot. I'm more in your world of like the writing and like storytelling. And to me, the storytelling lacks, and the movie storytelling still lacks, but it lacks a little bit less because they changed it.
Right.
So
yeah.
Okay, I want to talk about the movie.
Great. Yes.
This is now.
I have three areas of expertise generally, and the Cats movie is one of those areas. So let's go.
I want to hear. This is why you're here. I have not talked that much on this podcast about the movie, even though the movie is what spawned the podcast. I did do a review of it. I saw a press showing of it back before they fixed it. Like I saw the first week when it was still like half edited. I really do think you might be one of the only positive reviews I've seen on the show. Like you wrote a review and it is a positive review. So like, when did you see it? What is like, did you write that review? Like, was that an official thing for your, like the paper that you wrote it for? Or was this kind of for fun?
Oh, so yeah, that original review was for like the Georgetown Art Magazine. So I was a sophomore at the time. And you know, I know that the title is Cats Can Have a Reluctantly Positive Review is a Treat. One thing I wrote that title kind of as an attention grabber because yes, I write love towards the movie in this article. But I think I'm looking at it now. Like I think I spend about 80% of it critiquing the movie and then saying the only reason I enjoyed this was because I really like cats and anything about cats makes me happy. So it's technically negative, but
positive review I've still read about this at all. Even though there's critiques and everything about it, it's still a headline and an ending positive thing. Everybody else just rips on it.
Yeah. I mean, I said, what did I say? Let's see. I'm reading this. Okay. As I said, I unironically enjoyed Cats, but I've been unable to settle on any definitive reasons for this other than my loyalty to the original musical and what it stands for. Okay. So here's some very love letter lines about both the musical and the movie. The show's avant-garde integration of charm, and this was writing from 2 years ago, so I apologize for, I apologize. The show's avant-garde integration of charming British children's poetry with an Andrew Lloyd Webber score that incorporates a myriad of musical genres, and its inexplicable success, despite its unusual, potentially and frequently alienating premise, is immensely appealing to me as an example of a perilous creative venture that paid off and earned the love and respect of audiences worldwide. The story of the original stage production is a tale, of a nonconformist underdog rising to success, a love letter to creators, an encouraging word to the artistic renegade. Oh, gross. Okay. It's extremely pretentiously written, but that's, I think, one of the reasons I like the music. And it's not like an inner psychological thing. It is astounding to me. It is an inner psychological thing, but it's not the plurality of in the reasons that I like the show. It's amazing to me that something that has such a polarized, polarized reaction over time has been able to be so financially successful, and something that matches up so much with what I'm hoping to do with my work, which is creating entertainment for a wide audience that maybe uses anthropomorphic animals or, you know, Disney-esque storytelling to talk about social issues. Like at its root, even the stage musical is about the dangers of social tribalism. And so like I do political cartoons about Trump and the GOP and racism and environmental issues. And at the end of the day, like this musical, yes, it's entertaining and there's only a little bit of like a morality tale in there. But at the end of the day, it's about celebrating individualism while also being inclusive. That's at the root of the show. And so for something like that, where you're using anthropomorphic animals towards a social good, you know, eat your heart out, Zootopia, you know, I'm so thrilled that it did so well. And it captures a lot of what I'm hoping to do with my career. So it's
such an articulate way of basically being like, it's a cult. And we get to hear about each one of them. It's like, because the more I hear about the show, a lot of what you said, I think, resonates, which is there's no plot. The plot is that you're just getting to witness this family, this tribe, this group. Mm-hmm. And you're getting to your point, the individualism, you get to kind of hear about how they're all different, but they're still together in a family.
Right.
Then as I've learned more about the show, because granted, when I started this podcast, I'd seen it twice. And I didn't even see the movie at that point. I'd seen the show twice total.
Right.
That was it.
Right.
That was my whole understanding of the entire show was two Broadway revival productions. Or like matinees. I think I saw both matinees. So it's like, I didn't even go at night. I saw two o'clock on a Saturday or 3 o'clock on a Sunday shows.
Right.
And it is, I just started learning about how sexually over like tone there is. There's like Victoria's coming of age and Demeter's being abused and Grisabella's most likely a sex worker and all this other stuff. And then it's to your point, it's like, it's a kid's show. And I'm like, no, it's not. It's not a kid's show. But it is interesting that you say like it is like a parallel to all of the stuff, and it's a lot that you can relate to now, even though it's 41 years old.
Right.
And so it's like it's held true because of that. And I think to your a big part of what has kept it holding true is almost everybody can find somebody in the show or some cat in the show that they relate to. And so there is some personal like, oh, I kind of I'm that cat. And so I've enjoyed that piece because I can see myself in that character.
Right. And if you think about the source material, like I assume all of your listeners know, like it's a book of children's poetry. There's like 20 poems about just describing these adorable little individual animals and their little personalities. And it's a satire of cats as a species, of course, like in Mr. Mistopheles, if you read the poem, it's about cats that steal your stuff and how annoying they are. But it's like, ha, in his mind, he's a little magician. How cute is that? And like all of the poems are that.
Yes, except the part about this that Grisabella is not in the book.
Right.
Because
it's too sad. Right.
Too scary and too sad for children.
Right.
And then that is the premise for your entire show.
Correct.
Which is again goes back to we're going to build around a story that was too scary for children and we're going to make this a show that's mostly for children.
Right. And well, it makes sense if you think about the thesis of the book of poetry, which is this is a satire about cats, the species. Like, I don't think there's anything about unless you're really punching down at sad old cats, you know, there's nothing about the text of Grisabella, the glamour cat, that in any way is satirical. So I understand why he cut it for multiple reasons.
the root of the show.
Right. Which is interesting. Yeah. And I actually, you know, I'd heard that the Demeter backstory, but where did you get that from? Because I've heard that, but I've never been sure where that's pulled from or where the book of lore is or whatever.
This is what has become really challenging about this show is that there's 41 years of history. There's six different versions of Broadway tours in the U.S. And that's even more so when you really think about like six is technically pre-COVID and post-COVID, which were two totally different casts.
Right.
It's in Vienna running. It's been running in the U.K. It's been running on the West End. It's on a Royal Caribbean cruise. It's on they did the South Korea during COVID run. It's in Australia. I've been touring. So it's been running everywhere for so long. So there are some like the headcanons that are out there on the internet. And then there are, because each person does a slightly different version or has a different, because it's a very loose, like I think everyone says Chrissy Cartwright comes in and tells the story and there are a couple known truths. So like over my 70 episodes, I've heard versions of what people can remember they've been told about like their character. So it's like someone comes in and does a day where they go through the Book of Cats. And it's like, here's what you need to know about each one. And a couple of the like known truths are one is Demeter was in an abusive relationship with McCavity. That's like one of the known things. Victoria's dance is basically her losing her virginity. It's like a known thing.
That's so it's like, barely implicit, really.
Totally. Yes, totally. So there's a couple of things that are just like, this is fact. We know this is fact. And then there's a lot that is two characters or two actors playing it because they're friends off stage, or they decided they want to play this way, or they want to go. Jokingly, I've been talking about how my goal is to influence everybody's version of it by saying it. And I know I've influenced a couple where they've gone in and not materially influenced, but like, hey, you should play this character. Like, have you thought about playing this character with this relationship? Like, this person is this your mother. Have you thought about that way? And it's like, no. Right. And then say, go try that. Because it doesn't change the lyrics. It doesn't change the dancing. It's just change some reactions to the person. So I interviewed somebody else today, and I don't want to get anybody in trouble. So let's just say I have interviewed and convinced people to try some things, because that's been my goal of the show, is to slowly influence the outcomes of cats.
That was your secret plot.
That's my plot. That's been my goal. Only goal. So the only reason I keep doing this is I talk to people because my goal is to change the ending.
Right. Well, another way of saying that might be your ultimate goal is to add a plot to this stupid show. That's what you're trying to do very gradually.
I loosely want to. I don't think you can add a plot without. I mean, that's what the movie did. The movie tried to add a plot, and it kind of failed. Like, they basically said, we're going to take Victoria and make her the narrator.
Right.
And we're going to add in some others. Like, they tried to make McCavity a lot more villainous and make a true beginning, you know, like a conflict resolution type of thing. Like, they attempted to do that, and it didn't work. Like, it, like, objectively didn't work. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back for more of The Wrong Cat Died.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Can I actually ask, and I'm an English major, I'm ready for this, like, how did it not work? Because my biggest beefs with the movie were, I enjoyed the CGI, but I obviously see why that's a problem for the vast majority of human beings. And the slapstick was awful, and apparently the music was written wrong. I don't know how or why. I just,
well, there were some changes.
Every couple months, someone sends me that video. It's like, why the Cats movie music is bad. And I haven't watched it.
Well, the original Mungo Jerry Rumple teaser, like the British version.
Right.
So it's a totally different song.
I prefer that version.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know that. And I did enjoy that song when I saw the show. So it's like, oh, it's just completely different. I think they changed some numbers. The jump cut editing made it impossible to see any of the dancing. So I couldn't tell if the dancing was good or not. Like, I'm assuming, and Andy Wenkenbuehr is like an incredible choreographer, I assume that dancing, and they had amazing dancers.
Yeah.
I assume what they were doing was awesome. I couldn't see it because it was like you got repositioned so often that you couldn't really follow what was happening.
Right.
So, but to answer your question, I think from a storytelling perspective, I mean, I'm more of a sitcom fan. So I like the A, B storylines, like, and then tying them together at the end where there's like two conflict resolutions, many things happening, and hopefully they come together. And that's like all sitcom writing.
Right.
I think that there's Cats doesn't have that, because the whole point of Cats is you are being welcome in to watch this like ritual, this little piece of their world. And the whole story is, to your point, just getting to see the individualism. It's not really a singing competition like that, because otherwise Tugger doesn't think he's a choice. Like, and a couple of them don't think that they're there. So if it was a singing competition and they can't win, it's not really a competition. And then why is there this like orgy in the middle? Because the ball's an orgy.
It was a lunch break.
Yeah, the ball's an orgy. Like, that's another one of the like known facts. And so it's like, why would you have all this? So it's really hard to tie a story into it. And so it's like a redemption story technically, but you can't do a redemption story fully if you don't have Grizabella's whole backstory, which isn't what Cats is. The cat story isn't Grizabella's backstory. It's here's the tribe, and we're going to like get some assumptions about her. And then she's going to go in and quote unquote win. And so right. I think that they tried to force in, like, I need to give you a little bit of explanation because they were trying to build for a mass audience. Like, they should have just lived in a little world where it's like, let's just build this for the Cats fans and make it a little indie film and it would have been fine. But they built for the mass audiences, which means that you had to explain in the very beginning what in the world is going on. And they didn't really do that even that way very well.
Right. Well, I think part of the interesting aspect of the show, which we're seeing play out live in this conversation and conversations you've had with people, is that, it, like you said, it gives you a look into their world and gives you the opportunity to put headcanons on the characters. And it's built for people who enjoy the ability to do that.
Correct.
So if that's not something that interests you, then of course you're not going to enjoy the show. Shoehorning that in takes away part of the storytelling, I would argue, like magic and effect of the entire production.
And
but
you can do that on stage because if I ever see the show again, the first thing I want to do is I want to watch the twins. Because the twins are wild to me. Like, they're going to see stuff before, and I can do that because the main attraction can be happening in front of me and I can still watch the ensemble characters on the sides doing their thing. And they all are doing their thing, which is like an incredible acting skill because that's why they're staying in their character. In a movie, you frame stuff to see, like you tell the audience what you need to watch. There isn't the ability to just say, oh, I'm going to watch those two other cats the whole time because it's not being shot for you that way. And so that's a little bit of a challenge with the way that this whole thing is set up is you're supposed to immerse yourself in there. And a movie's not meant for you to do that. A movie's meant for you to be directed around to where you need to go.
Right. And that's ninja level analysis of why adapting something across media, like a stage show into a movie, is so much more difficult than simply, bringing a camera around through the stage, like the 1998 version, or storyboarding. It's so much more involved than that, especially for a story that relies so much on the audience's imagination and the ability to see all the characters in motion at once.
And I think they just spent a lot of money thinking, I have enough big names. Yeah, that it won't matter.
It
did, because every single person distanced themselves quickly from that movie. Don't want to be associated with it at all.
Can you imagine being Tom Hooper or like anyone who invested any significant amount of time on that? I would die.
I don't know how much time he invested in it because it wasn't edited until like the last minute.
That's true.
It felt very rushed. And, the timing of everything was very strange for me with that movie. Not just like when it came out, but even the trailer when it dropped. This movie's still not out. I just saw it's coming out. I think it might be out by the time that this releases. But the same day that trailer came out, Top Gun's trailer came out. And Top Gun was another like blockbuster, massive movie. And so even every decision along the way, even before it became a running joke, I was like, well, your trailer is being drowned by one of the biggest movie releases that's expected at that time. Top Gun was supposed to be huge. It released with either a Marvel movie or something else on the same weekend. So it released the weekend with some other huge, massive blockbuster movie. It's like nobody thought this through. Like the studio, I don't think whoever made decisions didn't think through a lot of things. And I think just assumed because you had Idris Elba, Taylor Swift, James Corden, Jason Derulo, like Rebel Wilson, like you had such big names, Jennifer Hudson, Judi Dench, you assumed, Ian, like you keep going. It's just like all of those names you assumed, it doesn't matter. People are going to go see it. And it was like the first group, I saw a press showing. And that should be a group of people that should be professional. Like you're there for an invited reason. You have to be invited to that version.
Right.
And people were cracking up in the first 5 minutes. And I'm like, if this group is laughing, this is not going to lend well for the general public.
No.
And so it became a running joke, and it's got to live on as a Rocky Horror type of thing is the only way that movie lives any further.
But and for like crazy, as a young, man. And as I guess as a younger fan who's only 2 years into this, but is way deep emotionally into this, like I think if I'm hoping to work in film and TV, and I'm not necessarily like aiming for like filmmaking as the jackpot. I think that's just not the cause I'm particularly interested in. If I ever get to the honor of adapting a movie, and I don't know, I've never made a movie. I've made lots of little YouTube videos. I've never made a movie. I have no idea how difficult it is. It's completely out of my depth. Obviously, I'm 22. But one thing I would really hope to do is not create a movie that makes people who are sincere, loving, honest fans of something feel embarrassed of the thing that they love. I think that is the ultimate failure. And as a Hobbit fan, a Hobbit movie fan, where seeing The Hobbit on December 23rd, 2012 was like a very formative moment for me as a person developing interests in sixth grade and middle school. Like it just was a formative experience for me that I was so deeply engrossed with something that basically was accepted by critics and most of my friends as something poorly executed. And that was interesting. I wasn't traumatized, but it was just a mental exercise that I had to really navigate. Maybe I learned things from it that have made me a better person, but that's just something I would really hope to avoid if I ever got, or anyone, if anyone directs some kind of adaptation of something. I hope that they identify that potential humiliation of fans as the ultimate thing of not to avoid, like the anti-jackpot.
I don't honestly don't think they put a single thought into that. I think it was it seems like a cash grab. It seemed like it was a really big budget with a good, like, it's enough of a vehicle that it could be done well. Like, I'm not convinced. I'm convinced it could be done well. If you'd have to curate a little bit of the story a little bit more. You'd have to do some of these things to make it a little bit more like dance heavy and focus on that, and maybe wide angle shot a lot more of it.
Right.
But it's got 41 years of stage success, and it's currently running in, I know of at least four versions currently running. So, it has the ability to like a show. You're seeing it now. All these Broadway shows are ending early and stopping because they don't sell tickets. Like, it's still selling. And so I think the movie could have sold. It was just really poorly executed.
Right. And this was the centerpiece of that quote unquote positive review, was that Tom Hooper chose to die on possibly the worst creative hill I could imagine, which is he identified the primary reason of the film's success, of the stage show's success, as being the illusion of seeing humans in cat outfits. And he chose to make that the centerpiece of his movie, the thing that you could not get past. Like, there's some creative decisions where it would be like a one and done thing, or you know, it's a passing thing, or it doesn't distract from the whole movie. But by choosing to die on that hill, he ensured that if that one thing screwed with audiences where they didn't enjoy that one thing, they wouldn't like the whole movie. And given how potentially polarizing that one decision is, it just baffles me that he went with that. I don't think anyone goes because they're eager to see humans dressed as cats. Why do they go? And I'm sure it changes for every person, but we can generalize. Like, they go for the music, they go for the spectacle, they go to see the sets, you know, they go to see... What do you think?
I definitely think when you go see it, it's the singing and dancing. Like, it's an incredible, like, you talk to anybody that's done it, it's one of the highest injury shows for dancers. A high level of injuries, because it is extremely demanding, because they're pretty much all dancing the entire time. And so I think that was when I first saw it the first time, and like, I made fun of the ending and the plot and, you know, the same kind of punchlines that everyone else can make. But I did walk out going, that is, and I saw Broadway revival.
Right.
That is peak performance of peak, like, of their ability, of that skill set, like, to tumble, to dance, to do those like different things. You're seeing extremely talented people doing something that is extremely demanding. And singing while they're doing it. It's one of the only shows, it might still be the only show, that the dancing is so demanding that they have singers in the booth that sing with the singers to help. Because it's so hard that, like, they have to just catch their breath when they can.
Right.
And so that, to me, is where it's like, that's what people, I think, go to see the show for. There's a little novelty, but I think that novelty wore off 25 years ago. You know, like, the novelty is kind of gone. Like, novelty probably happened in the 80s. But now it's like, the show's been running for 41 years. Like, you know what you're walking into, or you should have at least a general sense of what you're walking into. And so you're going to see these incredible performers sing and dance and do these extremely difficult numbers.
Right.
And so that's where I thought the movie, when I saw the cast, It's like of dancers, not the super celebrities, the dancers, right. Like the twins and they had some really talented dancers that I really mm-hmm. didn't get to see enough of. Like you just didn't get to watch it in the movie as the level you would want to.
Right. And they also, instead of making the centerpiece be the dancing, they chose to invent an entirely new centerpiece, which yeah. I think you could argue was the big name aspect. And, you know, I'm yeah. sure I don't think it's ever going to be possible to determine like how dependable is having a big name cast for getting box office returns. Like, I'm sure it's sometimes worked and sometimes hasn't because of a conglomeration of other reasons in various cases. But I think to have a movie which for the vast majority of like the mass American or worldwide movie viewing audience be a bunch of good actors being on screen in a like a grotesque manner, that's not gonna work because you can barely see that it's them. It's just like these freaky people with the Taylor Swift's face or whatever. That's yeah. not really Taylor Swift. Yeah. But you know, again, like I thought it was cool because it felt like I was watching one of my own dreams. Like I adored that, but I don't think the vast majority of people, clearly they didn't. Clearly they didn't enjoy that. But yeah, I thought it was fascinating and I would love seeing like the psychedelic like fireworks on display and amazing, but I don't think that works for most people.
It didn't land.
I'm glad it happened because it's yeah. like, oh my gosh, if you are like, if you sound authoritative enough, you can get movies like this made. Probably not for at least another couple decades, but I think I wrote that in that article.
Yeah,
like it, for someone who hopes to have one or two just total cult classic box office failure type achievements, maybe not movies but whatever, in my lifetime, like it brings me joy to know that something as ridiculous as this was actually created
for $100 million.
Uh-huh.
Like that's the part, it's like it wasn't just like some whim decision where it's like, oh, we'll make it and see what happens. Like they put a lot of money into this. Like they assumed this was going to be big.
Correct.
No. And it maybe it was yeah. it was in its own way. Yeah.
Fascinating. I it'll probably be written down in like film history books for various unflattering reasons.
I think it won 6 Razzies that year. And it created a fan in you. Without it, you'd be one less right. Cats fan in the world.
Oh, yeah. Right? I mean, yeah, yeah, that's right. And you have to wonder how many other people like that there are, because I probably wouldn't have heard about it. I wasn't plugged into like Broadway period. I enjoyed Les Mis, like the soundtrack, and my parents took me to see Beauty and the Beast on Broadway 3 times when I was 5, where I dressed as Cogsworth, and I was the only little girl in the theater dressed as Cogsworth. Like I enjoyed Broadway, but nothing close to what I'm trying to become now. And I'm actually just met with my new master's thesis advisor this week, and I'm hoping to write about the effect of British culture and politics on kind of the creation of Evita, Jesus Christ Superstar, and ideally Cats, if my advisor lets me shoehorn that in. And correct. Like the movie enabled me to learn about this, and I think hopefully just indirectly the movie probably did a lot of good for introducing people to a whole range of topics they might not have otherwise known about. I'm not naive enough to think that there's more than like 2 cases of that in the world, but hopefully it did happen.
Yeah. Love it. Yeah. I will anxiously be waiting to see your final thesis.
And thank if you're able you. To sneak
Cats in, if you need an authoritative figure like myself to be quoted in your thesis, I'm here, honestly, an expert on Cats.
Honestly, yeah, please. Well, yeah, I'm a contributing writer for DC Metro Theater Arts at the moment, and it's this like Washington DC based performing arts review preview publication. And I just learned a month or two ago that Cats is coming to the National Theater in January. So I wrote to my editor in advance with lots of like winky face laughing emojis. Like, look, I know it's however many months away, 8 months away, but please, can I call dibs in advance?
She's
like, yeah, fine, you can call dibs in advance. So
reviewing, got it.
If I do like commit a war crime and get fired from the publication in 8 months, you know, I don't want to look back on this with regret, but right now I am set to review it in 8 months.
I'm excited for you to see it on stage again.
Yeah, me too. I'll do it in costume.
Are you gonna go? Okay, do you have a Cats costume?
I do. I commissioned one from this amazing artist on, you can find her on Instagram. It's at Pixie Dust Jellicle. Her name is Kayla Bennett. And she does commissions for the entire outfits. And it brings so much joy, and it's brought my Georgetown buddies so much confusion and so much joy. And so it's been a real light of the last couple months here. So,
I love it. I have a tail. That's all I've got.
Hey,
so far.
It's worth money. It's like it's a couple fancy nights out, you know, for lots of joy and interesting Friday evenings when you're alone and bored.
I think it would shock most people to know this, but I don't think the majority of people that I know even know that I talk about cats on a podcast frequently. Really? It's surprising me because it's a fun like fact. It's a good two truths and a lie because it generally throws people off because it's not like a big part of my personality. I'm not a theater goer. I'm a theater goer. I'm not like a theater expert. I love going, but I go as a fan and I walk out confused of what I saw 90% of the time. And you can see, if you can see behind me, I've got two athletes, you know, like I've got more sports in my life than anything. I'm about to watch hockey and basketball this evening. but I do think it's like, it is interesting because it's like, it like owning one and having that and have like, I think it would confuse everybody. Even this hat, I'm wearing a hat from the podcast that someone got me, is like, most people don't even recognize that, that it's, you know, most of my friends aren't Cats fans.
And
most of them are Cats haters. So it sounds like we have a lot of mutual friends, that don't get the what's going on in this fandom.
My gosh, it's been, again, like I know that I bring it up at parties to seem interesting, I know that I do that, but it's sincere and I love talking about it. Like I was at this student council meeting for the Georgetown College Academic Council or whatever, like our end of my four years final pizza lunch thing, and I brought it up, or someone brought it up, and then I like lost it, like my eyes are already huge, but they got like three times the size, and like a dean from Georgetown University turned to me and you got freakishly excited. What is wrong with you? Like it's something that I think enables me to show joy to people and bring joy to people. And it introduces them to another kind of art that they might not have considered thinking about. And I get to teach them about how Steven Spielberg once did this interpretation of it during the Blitz, and, you know, Don Bluth, and learning about animation and storytelling. And I wrote all these articles analyzing it and one of the articles I wrote was about how T.S. Eliot once wrote this very famous article called Tradition and the Something Talent. I should know. I'm pulling it up. Tradition and the Individual Talent. There it is. And where he actually described like the recipe for making good art. And the idea basically was art needs to be made up of a series of individual elements that when combined work well together. And it's basically been a cautionary tale for me in conversation, like as a means of both my own thinking and talking about other people's art, for gauging how to create a successful work of art for niche audiences, for mass audiences. It's just this fascinating case study that's also about cute furry animals. It's been just an important presence in my life for me learning what kind of literature and what kind of media I'm interested in. And it also makes me seem interesting at parties.
I have the reverse. It's not brought up. And then whenever it comes up, it's like, oh, I probably know more about this than most people. Here I am. Like, what do you need to know? And then it's like, I've thought about this at length at the plot.
I
know a very specific set of it. Like, I couldn't tell you, it bothers some of the theater other people in our podcast network who they're like, yeah, this person was in Cats in the 80s. I'm like, I have no idea who you're talking about. Like, I'm like, they might be the most famous Broadway person, but I have no idea who you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but I can tell you that I don't think it's possible for Skimbleshanks' train to stop at the stations that are in his song if he's on the train that he does, because they shouldn't stop on that train station. And it's like, that's the level of detail of the story that I'm ready for, not anything about the singing, dancing, acting, whoever did it.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, speaking of knowing people from the 80s, so like I might have mentioned I run a satire publication at Georgetown, and I founded it 3 years ago, and I'm about to leave, and it's a whole emotional thing, and I pass it on to two new friends of mine, and I just got to meet, like, they're both Georgetown students, and I got to meet one of their moms, and it turns out, like, both of this kid's parents are actors and have been for like 40 years. And they were actually neighbors with Terrence Mann, who's like one of the original Rum Tum Tuggers. And so I bought myself, your listeners won't be able to see it, but I bought myself this like vintage figurine of him from, it's like 1984 or so. I don't know when Terrence Mann did it, but hypothetically I have original a figurine.
Broadway. He's one of the few I know, because I have spoken with him. And we have not been able to make an episode, but I have talked with him about doing an episode.
Right, and he was
a lovely human being, but he was the original Broadway Tugger.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So it's weird because I have a figurine of my friend's neighbor my desk.
That is so great.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I know. And it's just been a wonderful conversation starter. And like I said, like a method of literary criticism, which is just shocking given what it is, but
I love it
regardless. Yeah,
let's do some rapid fire. If you got to perform in the show, who would you want to be?
Given my current skill set, the only one that doesn't dance is Busta for Jones, so I would do that.
Pretend that you could do magically any of the singing and dancing, because I can't do any of them either. That's like same thing. And Busta for Jones, you'd have to be Gus too, so that would be hard.
Oh well, you know. How hard would that be?
Ignoring that, who would you want to do if you could do it?
My costume is Rumpelteazer. I think she's adorable, and hopefully some personality parallels there between me and her. I think her or the Rum Tum Tugger, he's cool.
Love it.
Love the vibe, the just unmitigated gall that he has. It's something I aspire to.
Yeah.
Just the complete lack of shame. It's precisely what I'm aiming for.
They are main character energy hardcore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who's your favorite and least favorite cat?
Favorite, probably. I think Rumpelteazer just has simultaneously just this wonderful eye-popping color scheme, and I love Garfield, and she's got Garfield's color scheme going on. Least favorite, that's tough. I don't like this fangirl thing that Etc. has. I think, the inclusion. I mean, of course, if you're going to have this rock star character, you need to show like the giggling teenage girls. But, that bothers me.
Yeah.
I've always been bothered that in McCavity, all the girl cats get up and start fangirling over him together. It's like, I feel like Rumpelteazer would have more dignity than that. So Etc. is kind of like the symbol of that mentality. So I've been considering if I were to get an additional costume, I might get hers just because it's an interesting color scheme. But I don't like the fangirl aspect that's carried through to multiple male cats. So
it's an easy answer for a lot of that. So I'm with
it, you. Yeah. Oh, and very quickly, like, it is such a bummer, and this, I don't know if this is a hot take, but you don't need to cut the entire number of Growl Tiger's Last Stand. Just change the two stanzas. That's it. Or make them, some other breed. It doesn't matter. Like, the point is that they're bad guys. Like, just make, even write out, instead of Siamese, just write bad guy cats. Like, I don't know, just when I was... one of the reasons I think I love this show is that I listened to it while walking around Georgetown and getting used to this new phase of like freedom in my life. And I used to listen to the Broadway production while walking around campus. And for whatever reason, just the operetta in Growl Tiger's Last Stand was this massively emotionally affecting piece of music for me. It sounds so silly to say, but it's just so unfortunate that they cut the whole thing because it's so unnecessary. And it's just honestly, I might be insane, but it's just one of the most beautiful pieces of music I've ever heard is that like 2 minute sequence. So I don't know if anyone's listening, just keep the whole song, just change the two stanzas.
It's a weird one because there's a couple reasons why it can get cut. So part of it is like, is it getting canceled? Or they need them to change it? Then they don't want to really change lyrics because they try to stay true to the poems. So they've in general not done that. There's also, you have to find someone that can sing operatic part, which isn't always necessarily the same because it's one, I think it's Gus, right? Isn't Gus usually Growl Tiger? So like you need a Gus that could do that as well. And so sometimes it's not the decision as like for the lyrics, it can be a decision because of other rationales there. And they've done that in some other shows where there's like this person isn't like somebody else is going to sing this number, which is not the normal way they do it because they found an incredible dancer to do that role, but maybe not sing it for other pieces. So,
gotcha. Yeah, well, I guess adjusting my take to account for new information. Please don't cut it purely because of those two stanzas.
Yeah.
Please don't do that. Yeah, it's not necessary.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I understand. And also, like, I know in the Broadway version from 1983 or 4, it changes based on which Wikipedia article you pull up. The guy who sings Gus, it sounds like he is Gus, like an older dude who isn't that good at opera singing, trying to do his best job at opera singing. So yeah, like you'll need a good opera singer for Griddlebone or, you know, Jelly Lorum, right? But you don't need an expert. Well, you can do someone who's passable, like who sounds comedic about it, but
You can go and find, I don't know if you'll be able to find it at a local bookstore, but the Gus was Stephen Hanna, I believe is how you say his name.
Oh, okay.
And
sure.
He wrote a diary about his time. Like he published his diary during the rehearsals of the Broadway production. And he talks about Griddlebone and Growltiger because it's a part that was like a big part of him forming it. So it's a book you should, as a fan and English major and all this stuff, like
Growltiger enthusiast.
It's here for you. It's like 100 pages. It's really not that long. I read it recently. And it's like his handwritten notes. So it's like it reads like a diary.
Oh, that's cool. I absolutely should read that. Yeah, hear that, listeners. You should read that.
It was hard to find, so I will emphasize that like it's not a well published book anymore. You can find it on that big online retailer for books, but you might be able to find it at a local bookstore. I don't know.
Yeah, no, definitely. I was on eBay the other day and I came across, I forget what it's called, you probably know, but some original actor who played Bustopher Jones at a minimum, maybe among other roles, but definitely Bustopher Jones because he was on the cover, like A Cat's Story or A Cat's Diary. And
that's him. That's Stephen Hanna. Yeah.
That's the one. Oh, okay,
Bustopher
gotcha.
Jones is Gus and Bustopher Jones. So it's, track is called Bus Gus.
Yeah. Got it. Okay.
Yeah, so that's the book.
Yeah, there it is. Okay, great.
It's if you haven't read it, you should. It's great. It was really interesting read. About like hearing it from Joanne Lynn and like what creating because this is basically creating the show at this point. Like it was still early on where they were figuring it out. So that might have been, I don't know if it was original Broadway, I don't remember where, but it was like helping develop the characters.
Wow. Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Once I get my Georgetown senior ball dress and know how much of a chunk that's taken out of my bank account, I will spend the $5 to buy my copy. Thank you.
Yeah. <Amazing. laughs>
I am frightened. Yeah.
Anyway, yes. What about favorite song from the show?
Oh, I love, I think Skimbleshanks. You can't really beat that.
So fun.
I actually did from an animation project, and I know we're running low on time, so I'll keep this brief, but for an animation project for a Georgetown class 2 years ago, we were asked to make an animated music video for some piece of music. And so I chose the movie version of the overture. And I got, so you might have heard of Copic or Copic markers. It's like alcohol markers. So the ink, the idea is like the ink blends when it's on paper. I don't know if that made it different from other inks when put in water, who knows? But basically I took a pan of water and I squirted alcohol marker ink into the water pan, had a camera above it, and just slammed the take picture button like as fast as I could, and then made a stop motion video of the liquid of different colors moving around. And I had that line up with the overture. And like, to be honest, that thing is one of my most prized personal pieces of artwork. It's one of the things I'm most proud of.
Somewhere?
Yeah, no, it's on my website.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's also on my Instagram, but from a year or two ago. But in terms of the songs, I love just the energy of Skimbleshanks is awesome. But there's something just magical about the melodies that Andrew Lloyd Webber came up with that sound just psycho, but they work so well.
Totally.
If you listen to them enough times, they start to make sense.
Yeah,
so, exactly. Raises eyebrows and like it's a cult. But
I love it. All right, $1 million question.
Mm-hmm.
I've argued at length. I don't think Grisabelle was the right Jellicle choice. Do you agree with me? Or if you're defending Grisabella, whoever you're defending, I want to hear your rationale for who should go.
Sure. I mean, I think it really depends on the answer to this question really depends on what you think death is and what you think the Heaviside Layer is and your belief in the religion that these cats have chosen to follow. If you think that the Heaviside Layer is in fact heaven of some kind, like some kind of superior existence, then I think that it should have been Munku Strap, simply because of what he did for the tribe and protecting them and guiding them through. I think in terms of having accumulated the most like moral high ground, I think, yeah. And social capital, I think it should have been him. If you think that it's hell or nothing, then McCavity probably, especially if you're going off of the abuse thing. Mm-hmm. So that would be my answer. Is that a reasonable answer?
I think it's interesting. I've not actually taken that. I've never heard that version. Like what is the, because I think the part that makes this so interesting is it's an annual thing. So mm-hmm. if it's an mm-hmm. annual thing, I always think about criteria of who gets right. chosen, like who was picked last year, who's picked next year.
Right.
And so that's a different and like interesting way to think about it is like depending on what mm-hmm. you think the Abyssal layer is, because I think most people assume it's a cat being reborn. So it's like you go, you die, and then you come back as something new. And there's some pieces that you could assume in there, like I've heard right. assumptions that Victoria was last year's and that's why she's the new kind of young.
Wow. Ooh,
I've heard I also think sure. there's like a baby Grizz that dances in the opening number in the current show. That's I think just mm-hmm. they needed another ensemble character, but I'm like, is that foreshadowing right. her right. being choice because that's her reborn character. Right. So there's like some stuff like that that can go. But if you think about it that way, it does give a different question of like who's worthy based on that. And that is, right. The Monkey Shop's probably your answer there.
Yeah. He seems to have done the most for the common good. And in terms of deserving some reward for that, if the only available reward besides, you know, food or, you know, or a trip to the dumpster where Busterberg Jones gets his food. Yeah. Like if that's the only available reward on the table, then yes, dying and being reborn would be the best option.
Yeah. I love it. I think you got a different way to think about it, which I like.
Thank you.
Does that answer, is it you're still the same answer for the movie, for the 2019 movie? Is Munku Strap still your choice there?
He seemed to play less of a role. Like mm-hmm. in the movie, it seemed like he was just Victoria's guide as opposed to the audience's guide.
Yeah.
I struggle to remember off the top of my head moments where, unlike old Deuteronomy, Munku Strap actually looked into the camera and addressed the audience. So I feel like he did less for the group there.
Yeah.
I'd have to watch.
Talks to you.
Right. I'd have to watch the scene on the boat again to figure out which one had the idea to rebel and mutiny and cut things loose. I feel like was it Jenny Anydots who did that on the barge?
I've seen the movie the one time in the press and I didn't make it to the barge the second time because I tried to show my family when it came out on video, or like it was out to watch wherever it was playing. Right. And they got about halfway and they looked at me and they go, does this get any better? And I think it was Taylor Swift. And I go, not really. And they're like, okay, we're done. And they turned it off. So I don't remember at all. Yeah. I have to rewatch it.
It's funny. I was at a friend's house in October and we had actually really hyped it up. Like, we're going to watch Cats and it's for Alex, but we're also excited to see this monstrous movie. And then like two of them left 20 minutes in and didn't come back until the following morning. Apparently they were walking around the National Mall for no reason. Like they'd rather walk around the National Mall at 2 a.m. and put themselves in danger of being like mugged or shot instead of watching this thing. So I've been there in a very precise way. I've been exactly there.
They made a decision and I'm not sure I might've been walking with them. I need to watch it again. I did watch the 1998 movie. The very first time I watched it was about halfway through me recording I did monologues for the first 10 episodes where I explained which cat was more worthy. And it was probably about halfway through that. And I watched it on a plane. This was pre-COVID. I was traveling a bunch for work. And let me tell you, watching Cats on an iPad on a plane gets a lot of really weird looks. So even that, I was distracted because everyone's looking over my shoulder. Everyone's looking at me. And I was like dressed up for work. So I was like, I look pretty professional.
No, you dressed up specifically just to watch Cats.
Yeah, to watch Cats on a plane.
This is important.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I got a lot of looks. And so I don't remember even that. I've seen that in pieces more. But the 2019 movie, it was one full viewing. And that was probably more than most people.
You've made me want to buy a plane ticket for the pure, singular purpose of just watching cats on it, maybe in costume, just to get reactions.
You will. I live in New York and I ride the subway all the time. And all the time I'm always like on the subway, I'm like, you could be in a cat's costume. It wouldn't be the weirdest thing you see on the subway.
Yeah, I'm going to Broadway Con this summer, and I'm already doing preliminary logistical plans, and I'm like, I'm probably going to have to stay somewhere, and I'm not going to want to do the whole 45-minute face thing in the bathroom at the con. Like, I'm probably going to have to ride the subway, and I'm having to come to terms with that.
We will, I did a live episode at the last in-person one, which was to like February, I think, of 2019. It was our 2020.
Oh,
it was
gosh.
Like right before.
Yeah.
And I did have somebody in a Mistopheles costume. It was awesome.
Hey.
So I should be there this year. So
great. Oh my gosh.
We
Yay.
Should, we will be there. But
hypothetically, I'm running an Andrew Lloyd Webber cosplay panel, but I'm like a month late on giving them my logistical plan. It's not even a panel. I just said, hey, you should put on the schedule that everyone with an Andrew Lloyd Webber costume should meet up somewhere. And so like they asked understandably for like PowerPoints explaining or with the content of my presentation. And I just, even with the reduced amount of work that my idea involves, I have been like 2 months late. So hopefully I still can do it and I don't have to buy a $300 ticket as a result of my delay. But yeah, I'm running that if that happens.
I will probably not be in costume, but I'll be there. I can bring
the shirt that you're wearing.
I have the shirt. I'm wearing a Jellicle shirt. I have a shirt that's a cat lifting weights. It says training for the Heaviset Layer.
That's cute.
So I can wear my cat stuff. I love it. How can people stay in touch with you? Like website, social media, like how can we follow your political satire and everything else?
Thank you. Yeah, please. I think Instagram's the platform I'm trying to build up the most at the moment. Just the algorithm is killing me. It's killing artists in general. I think it has since decades ago or whenever it was founded. So Instagram at Alexandra Bowman Art, spelled like it sounds. And then Twitter would be great too. I did political cartoons for the Lincoln Project. So I'm lucky to have developed a significant following of like 21,000. It keeps alternating between 20.9 and 21K. So if you can just help me get over that, that would be nice. So that's scripta_bene, because my email address is bene.scripta, because when I was 12, my mom told me to pick an email address that I wouldn't have to change later on. So according to Google Translate, written well or good writing is scripta bene, or bene scripta, which I've been told is not correct. So I'm just I was hoping to keep that private, but I think I've screwed myself over to some degree.
So spell Twitter. I'll link it too, but spell Twitter for anybody that's
thank you. It's at scripta, @scripta _bene, @bene. At scripta underscore bene. Yeah.
Perfect.
Thank
we'll link it. We'll link it in the description, but just for anyone listening. So
please.
This is awesome.
This has been a joy. Thank
so
you,
fun.
Mike. Oh man. I wish I could do this all the time. I have all these takes that I can't tell anyone without them running from me. But anyway, I appreciate it.
I
have joined a cult. It's a cult about cults.
It's a cult on a cult.
You can use that in your thumbnail on your post about this episode. It's a cult about cults.
It's a cult about cults. Yeah, you've had some great lines here. So we definitely got some quotes from this. So, thank you for being an amazing guest, and thanks everyone else for listening to this episode of The Wrong Cat Died, the podcast breakdown of the catastrophe. To follow along, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Wrong Cat Died, or check out our website, thewrongcatdied.com.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway, Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.